Somehow I had gotten ahead of Henry. I stopped and waited as he made his way up in my footprints. If you were tracking him, it would have been as if he had disappeared. He held out his hand, and I pulled him up. To my surprise, he was breathing heavier than I thought he should, so I caught him as he shifted the Weatherby to his other hand. "You all right?" I looked around at the collection of peaks that ringed the area. There was hardly any lower ground than where we now stood. "I do not wish to dampen your spirits, but this is a wonderful place to be shot. Kind of like being in a toilet bowl." We were in the open, with the deep cover of pines darkening into the surrounding area. I was having one of those creeping grave-step feelings. "Let's go." At the end of the ridge, the trail deflected into two paths that circled a large boulder and separated as one continued the high road around the far lake and the other dropped into the depression where the tent was pitched. It was a good spot, dry but close to water. It didn't have too much of a view, but it was well protected from the wind. I looked back up the valley to the northwest and could more clearly see the dark line of clouds that continued to eat up the western sky. It was calm at the moment, but the intersecting triangles of black granite and fresh snow seemed to be holding their breath in preparation for what was coming. They looked like long teeth. Henry put out a hand to stop me and looked down at the path. "Tracks." He lowered to one knee, shifting his shoulders back so that the weight of the pack wouldn't propel him down the hill. "How big is George Jesper?" I blew out a breath and thought. "Under 6 feet, maybe 170 pounds. "Size 9, Vask hiking boots." I froze. "What?" He looked up, his eyes very sharp. "Vask hiking boots. Looks like a size 9. Means something?" "Is there a little pattern on the arch, like a little mountain range?" He didn't look. "Yes." His neck strained as he scoped the surrounding area. I leaned over his shoulder and looked at the print. "Is there something you would like to tell me?" I was looking around now, too. We had prints like these at the scene where Jacob was killed. He stood. "So, George was there?" "We checked them, and one of the guys that reported the incident wore size 9 Vasks." "What was Jacob wearing?" I thought back. "The same. Size 9? They are twins." "Well, one set of prints is better than two, not that I'd be able to tell the difference." We continued down the trail to the tent. The rain fly was zipped, and there was a backpack leaned against a tree with the rain cover placed over it. The small ring of a campfire lay cold in a circle of rocks about 10 feet from the tent. There was an aluminum frying pan and a plastic bag of cornflour resting on one of the flatter rocks. The heads of a few trout lay in the ashes, along with the strips of bone with connected tails. Henry kneeled by the fire and placed the palm of his hand in the ashes, gently pressing down. After a moment, his eyes came up. "It is old, but there is a little warmth here, maybe this morning." "Any more tracks?" He nodded. "Vasks, size 9. We looked at each other for a moment. "I don't like this, do you?" "No." He pulled his hand up and dusted it off as I continued over to the tent and slipped the pack to the ground, then crouched and unzipped the rain fly and the screen on the tent. I pulled back and turned to look at Henry. "Well, he spent the night here."
"But no fishing equipment?"
"No." He looked around.
"I will take one lake and you take the other.
Here." He tossed the Weatherby to me and extended his hand for the shotgun. He smiled as he took the Remington.
"You are a better shot than I am."
He scanned the surrounding hills.
"Just in case there is somebody up there."
I nodded. "You got the rest of the ammunition?" He patted his pockets and shrugged.
"You only need one, right?"
Henry turned and disappeared into the pines toward the eastern lake. I looked at the rifle and considered whether it was loaded or not. For all I knew, the bear was standing just out of sight, listening to see if I would open the bolt action. I shook my head at the ridiculousness of the situation and pulled the .308 up onto my shoulder. If he was standing out there, I wasn't going to give him the satisfaction of hearing me check. Instead, I readjusted the forgotten .45 on my hip and made a face at a man I was sure had already begun the search around his own lake. I started off around mine, thinking about what Ruby had said. Just because someone had sighted an old green pickup didn't mean Henry was a killer. In my experience, smoke usually indicated smoke, and nothing more. There were coal-bed methane operations in the vicinity of the Roberts' place. To these men, time meant money, and time in our part of the High Plains meant driving, which to them meant speeding. From economic necessity, a lot of them drive older outfits, and any one of them could have been speeding to or from one of the many rigs in the area at that hour in the morning. I knew I was working up a grand rationalization, but just because a truck was green and old didn't mean that it was Henry's. Even so, I once again had the urge to pull the bolt and see if the rifle was loaded. I looked back at the other twin, but kept the rifle on my shoulder, considering it a triumph of righteous logic, and wondered how many poor dumb bastards had died in the name of that particular line of thought. I stayed on the path that circled the lake, careful to avoid the wetter sections where the snowmelt had gathered and saturated the ground. But I didn't see any more footprints. I bolstered my spirits by reminding myself that I'd also not found any bodies. Vasks, size 9. Had George been with Jacob? If he had, then why? And why would he be at the scene of his brother's death and then go fishing? Maybe Cody Pritchard did know his killer. My head was starting to swim with all the options, but one thing was starting to come clear. Just because you were a victim didn't mean you couldn't be a perpetrator. I thought about Jim Keller. Mrs. Keller had come into the jail to check on her baby boy, and had been somewhat disarmed at finding him in my office with his feet propped up on my desk. He was drinking a ginger ale and leafing through a stack of police supply catalogs. I guess she figured we'd have him chained up in the basement. I asked her about Jim, and she said that he was hunting down in Nebraska with some friends. Geese, she said. There was a hesitancy in the way she said it that led me to believe there was something more there, so I used one of my age-old cop tricks and asked her if there was anything else she wanted to tell me. She used one of the age-old mother tricks and just said no. Cop tricks pale in comparison with mother tricks. I looked back around the crescent ring of mountains and thought about what I would do if I wanted to kill someone here. I thought about how I might lure him into a remote area and then splatter him like a ripe pumpkin. It was about then that I decided to concentrate on taking in more of the scenery. Lost Twin is a lot like the other hundreds of pristine alpine lakes in the Bighorns that seem to be sitting and waiting for calendar photographers. It lies in one of the mountain's few hanging valleys, and you could easily envision the tributary glacier that had gently cut this hidden one. With their beds of stone, the Lost Twins had given up little to the forces of erosion. It was as if their hearts had been broken by the retreating glacier, and they were not likely to allow such liberties again. These glaciers formed steps and benches, each successive one at a higher altitude. I had seen pictures of the Colosseum in Rome, and the similarity did nothing to ease my mind. I felt the wind and automatically looked back down the valley. The clouds were starting to move at a surreal pace. Evidently, they had caught their breath. Maybe it was the altitude, but the weather always seemed to change more quickly on the mountains. My attention was brought back to the trees where I had seen movement. It wasn't a singular movement, but rather a collection of movements that I quickly dismissed as the wind. Omar was still fiddling with the helicopter when I reached the hill leading up to the ridge. I stood there, and the air tasted good. I took a little bit of time to breathe in the smells of the pines, the rocks, and the water. There was a large patch of delicate, freeze-dried yellow flowers that lined the south side of the small ridge. Henry would know what they were. He was making his way around the scree-lined bank of the other lake, probably doing a much more thorough job than I had done with mine. I watched as he crouched down and studied a shallow area between the rocks. The acrylic fur wreathed his neck, and the scattergun was resting lightly on his shoulder as he held the pistol grip. He stayed that way, and I had the feeling I was getting a select view of the Athapascan race that had braved the Bering Strait in search of two bigger and better mastodons in each garage. Sometimes I didn't think his DNA thought things had worked out so well. I wasn't quite sure why I had decided on the shotgun, other than it balanced out the 308's long-range capacities. And, like a good scout, I was always attempting to be prepared or reverent or something like that. I continued to watch him as he studied a shallow area between the rocks and peered across the lake toward the area of the tent. As Henry made it to the top of the ridge, I asked, "Anything?" He shook his head and looked back in the direction from which he had come, as if whatever he might have missed would be more visible from half a mile away. The wind was picking up, and the gusts were becoming more consistent. "Boot prints, same as before, but nothing fresh." "What do you think?" He stretched his legs and tucked the shotgun under one arm. I noticed the safety was on. "Difficult to say with all the scree. He could have gone off anywhere." "Alien abduction?" "Possible, but unlikely. They are usually looking for intelligent life." I exhaled a lung full of the good smells, and we both looked down the valley to the trail out. "He's fishing."
"Yes, that, or a lion and a moldering in the grave."
I looked back at him. "Let's concentrate on the fishing, okay?"
"Yes."
He continued looking down the trail.
"You need water for that."
He finally looked back at me.
"You thinking what I am thinking?"
"3 hours in good weather?" His eyes watched the clouds. They were even closer than before.
"I do not think that is going to be the case. Anyway, 4 with the packs."
I tried not to put too much bass in my voice. "I wasn't planning on taking them." He raised an eyebrow.
"Do you mind jumping up and down so I can hear your big brass balls clank?"
"It's only 3 hours.
In good weather, which we are not going to have."
He looked at his wristwatch as a particularly strong gust caused both of us to shift our shoulders.
"Even then it'll be after dark."
I continued to look at him.
"We get caught in here without any supplies, we are the honored dead."
"Yep, but what a blaze of glory." I was enjoying being the tough guy for a change.
"I am more concerned with the freeze of agony.
I have to find that kid, dead or alive." I watched as he stretched his back and looked toward Omar, who stood at the nose of the helicopter with his arms folded. My 45-minute window of opportunity already had the storm shutters closed and was prepared to depart at roughly twice the national speed limit. I briefly thought about telling Henry to go on back without me, but it would have been an insult, so I just stood there waiting.
"We find him dead, we leave him." I lied.
"Agreed."
"I will get some supplies from the packs. I refuse to leave here without water and some food."
"We could always eat George if we find him." I watched after Henry as he crossed the ridge toward the tent where we had left the packs. His step seemed to have lost some of its natural spring. I called after him,
"How long till snow?" He called back without turning, "How the hell should I know?" Maybe we were going to die.
I trudged up the hill toward the helicopter and Omar. "You need to get out of here." He pushed the Ray-Bans further up on his nose.
"What are you going to do?"
"We're going to trail out back to West Tensleep. That kid's here somewhere, and I figured the only thing to do is follow the water out.
You and the Indian?
I looked at my reflection in his polarized sunglasses.
Yep.
I didn't mean for it to have as much warning as it did, but that's the way it shook out. He didn't say anything, just opened the cockpit door and reached in to retrieve a handheld that he gave to me. The rotors pitched slightly as another gust rushed up the valley.
It's already set at your frequency, so if you need to talk to anybody, you should get through, as long as you've got reception.
Thanks. He looked at me for a moment as if memorizing me, and I can't say it was comfortable.
I notice you're carrying your 308.
We traded. He considered it for a moment.
Make sure he stays ahead of you.
His face was stiff.
I'm not joking.
I looked at him and thought about saying a number of things.
We'll be all right.
I waited a moment. Get in touch with Ferg and Vic and tell them to meet us at West Tensley parking lot, if you would. We both looked back at the weather.
Tell them to bring hot coffee.
Omar sighed a deep sigh, climbed into the helicopter, and held the door open with a foot. He began flipping switches, and from the center of the machine, a high whine began slowly setting the rotors in motion. He started to place the headphones over his ears, but stopped, leaned sideways through the still-open door, and shouted to be heard over the increasing roar of the big engine.
"You tell that Indian, if he comes out of here alone..."
I waited.
"I will see him dead."
I lowered my head, held the Weatherby in both hands, and quickly dropped over the ridge. The deep hues of the helicopter's exterior reflected the lakes. It quickly rose from the rocks and veered toward the center of the valley as a few pieces of the trimmed lodgepole pines scattered and dropped to the ground. A strong blast of the oncoming storm caught the chopper broadside, sending it in a cascading pitch that threatened to drop it in the lake below. Omar deflected the wind pattern and converted the stall into a rolling turn that carried it across the valley. I continued to watch for the next minute as he made the grade and slipped through the pass and down the mountainside toward the safety of Durant International far below. I walked the rest of the way down the hill and met Henry at the ridge.
Neiman Marcus decided not to honor our frequent flyer miles.
That is what we get for flying coach. He handed me an abbreviated version of my pack. The tops disconnect from the rest to make a fanny pack. We both have 2 bottles of water and a little food, but that is all.
A jug of wine and thou.
He didn't say anything, but turned and started off down the banks of the western lake toward the trail that would eventually lead us out. A haze had begun enveloping the hills where the trail disappeared. The fog of low-flying clouds had begun eating the mountains, and we were headed down its throat. I wasn't quite sure why I was feeling as good as I was. Maybe it was because I had perceived a challenge and had accepted it, or maybe it was because I didn't see any other options. But I felt good and decided not to ruin it with too much recrimination. I caught up and pulled alongside of him.
He can't be too far since he left all his stuff at the lake.
Or he is dead.
I wish you'd stop saying that.
He turned his head slightly toward me as he walked. Would you go out this way fishing and leave all your supplies at the lake?
He's not the brightest bulb on the Christmas tree.
Maybe.
What's that supposed to mean?
I noticed that he had tied some tubular webbing from the packs to the shotgun, making a sling, which he now pulled up higher on his shoulder.
Do you remember what George Esper looks like?
I thought for a moment.
Yep.
I remember what Cody Pritchard looked like. I remember what Brian Keller looks like, and I have a pretty good image of what Jacob Esper looked like, but whenever I think of George, I cannot seem to bring the image into focus. I thought about the pictures, the ones I kept in the little bird file, the ones I had cut from the Durant High School yearbook. I had studied them enough over the past few years that I should have been able to tell you every significant feature of George Esper's face. But I couldn't. I shook my head.
Look, maybe we're getting worked up about nothing. Maybe he's just waiting for his brother.
He started down the trail and called over his shoulder.
He will be waiting for a long time.
We climbed the hillside in the Forest Service's zigzag pattern that led to a granite outcropping where the runoff from the lakes escaped to the rocks below. The wind picked up again, and the cold air found every inch of uncovered skin on my hands, ears, and neck. I looked down the valley and at the trail we would be using as the snow began overtaking everything within a quarter mile. In 2 minutes, it would be to us. Henry had stopped, too, to pull up the government-issue parka hood and to look back at the lakes. I pushed his shoulder.
"Considering the situation, why don't you talk about something happy?"
I watched as he tied the drawstring at his neck.
"I thought I was."
He shifted the shotgun from his shoulder and cradled it in his arms, first looking down the trail at the approaching wall of snow, then off to the distant lakes. His eyes softened at the view, and he seemed sad.
"These young men, when they did what they did to my niece, for me they no longer existed. For good or bad, they were gone."
His eyes returned to mine.
"Do you understand?"
His eyes stayed with mine.
"It is the best I can afford them."
I waited a moment, but it seemed as if he wanted me to say something.
"All right."
He smiled, and once again threw the makeshift strap of the shotgun over his shoulder.
"It is far from that, but it will have to do."
He continued to smile, then flipped the flaps down on his fingerless gloves and twisted his fingers into the mitts. The smile warmed me, even as the flakes began stinging my face. He threw a paw up and thumped my shoulder twice.
"Anyway, revenge is a dish best served cold."
With this, he turned and walked into the low-flying clouds and the maelstrom of snow that had reached us. I listened as the drums began a low rhythm and watched as the broad shoulders picked their way carefully down the trail. The world began to turn white, and the bear disappeared. Chapter 12. Even in the snow-muffled air and the distance between us, I heard the gunshot. We had been battling our way through the wind and the snow. It was an early storm, so the flakes were as big as silver dollars, and with the force of the wind, hit with the same impact. Henry and I had worked our way over the slight rise and outcropping, staying to the right as the trail followed the general path of the stream, and had moved past Mirror Lake with no results. The water continued to run fast from the hanging valley, and you could hear it when the wind died down, which it did, but with lessening regularity. The blizzard had arrived. Visibility had dropped to about 20 feet, and you couldn't see much of anything except the creek. The Forest Service path remained visible as it wound its way along the stream basin, but in another hour the depression that made up the trail would be filled with the fast accumulating snow. I took a small measure of solace in the fact that the part that led to the West Tensley parking lot was not only tree-covered, but downhill, and we didn't have that far to go before we would get to that section. But the farther we got, the farther my heart sank with the thought that George Esper was not going to be found. I had already summoned up the image of George's bones, scattered by all the little animals by springtime, their bleached white contrasting sharply with the green of the fresh high meadow grass. I watched as Henry's image faded in and out of the white swarm of the blowing snow. Every time he disappeared, I quickened my step a bit, wanting comfort from the dark shape that stayed just ahead of me. Was the killer here? The last two murders had been within easy reach of roads, of quick access and egress, so I didn't think so. But what about the boot prints? It was a popular boot, in a very popular size, and the possibility that George, Jacob, and some guy from Casper wore the same shoe wasn't out of the question. I just about convinced myself that it was coincidence when I heard the shot. It was not the report of the Remington I knew Henry was carrying. It was close enough that I thought I might have seen the muzzle flash.
Hearing the sound of a gunshot when you're not expecting it is like sticking your finger in a light socket. But hearing this gunshot was more like sticking that finger into a fuse box. I know I jumped, because I had to catch myself from slipping on the freezing ground and falling into the icy water. I wasn't aware that I had started running, or how fast I covered the distance between us, but the next thing I saw were two distinct figures in the swirling haze of snow. One was seated in the path with his feet before him and was slouched forward, and the other was standing over the first and held something in his hands. With the keening of the wind, they didn't hear me coming, even though I'm sure that the pounding of my feet and my ragged breathing alone was enough to get the dead to roll over. For some reason, I hadn't unslung the rifle during my run, but was just now slipping it from my shoulder and gripping it with both hands. It was like falling into an impressionist painting, with the snowflake pointillism giving the image a surreal quality. As I surged forward, I knew it was Henry on the ground. It wasn't a big person that I hit, and I didn't recognize a single aspect of his appearance as we collided. I know he didn't expect me because there wasn't any resistance when I got there. I was carrying the rifle forward, but I didn't swing it. Instead, I used it as a battering ram. In hindsight, I suppose I could have used the thing with a little more strategy, but calculation didn't play much of a part in my reaction. When he went, I went over with him into the cloud of snow and down the bank leading to the creek. When we hit the ground, the first time, the rifle came up and caught me at the bridge of my nose, but the majority of the impact went directly into his head, which snapped back as the stock of the big Weatherby slammed into the side of his jaw. I'm pretty sure I heard the crack of bone as he went down, with me smothering him as we went. The second time we hit the ground was the last, and the roll converted into a slow slide on the bank of the stream in axle grease mud. I felt a sharp pain in my lower left-hand side. Something dug into my short ribs and felt as though it had suddenly yanked on my insulated coat as I heard a muffled report. Even in the windstorm, the smell of spent gunpowder and quartzite stung the air. I slapped a hand down to the area where the gun must have been, and I could feel the small revolver that was wedged between our mutual diaphragms. The grip that held it was limp. There was accumulated moisture between us, and I couldn't tell if it was from the fall or if either of us had been shot. I stripped the revolver from the open hand of whomever it was that had held it and lay there for a moment to make sure he really was out and to catch my breath. After a moment, the bass of Henry's voice strained into the wind. "Are you hit?" His voice was thick, and I could tell he was hurt. I grunted, rolled off the inert figure, and felt my side. I looked back up the hill. "No, I don't think so. I'm just trying to get my heart out of my throat. You?"
"Who is it?"
I pulled myself up on one elbow and looked down at my victim. His face was turned and buried in the hood of a Gore-Tex jacket. I used the stock of the rifle to leverage myself up into a position more suited to looking and reached out to turn the face toward me. His chin grinded a little as I pulled the face around, indicating that some damage had been done, but aside from the askew jawline, it was the mostly intact face of a watered-down Jacob Esper. "George Esper." Henry's voice was still thick, but there was a little more animation.
"Is he hit?"
"I don't know.
Check him. I can wait."
I sat up completely and looked in the general vicinity of where I thought George might have been shot and found nothing. The words were just coming out of my mouth when I noticed a small tear in his full-zip pants. Shit. I pulled off my glove and ran it over the black fabric. It was coated with his blood. Shit.
"He is hit?"
"Yep." I tore the pants open to reveal an entry and exit wound at the front of his thigh. "Subcutaneous damage, possibly the thigh muscles. Missed the bone and major arteries, though."
"Can you stop the bleeding?"
I sighed. "Maybe, but he's not going to be able to walk." I took one of my gloves, turned it inside out, placed the fleece-covered leather over both holes, and looked around for something with which to tie the glove in place. The small pack was still attached to my middle, so I stripped the water bottles off and emptied it out, wrapping it around his leg. I raised his head up and peeled back an eyelid. What showed was mostly white. He gave no sign of coming to. I had seen his chest rise and fall, but I felt his wrist just to make sure I hadn't killed him. The pulse was strong, but he remained still.
I checked George's leg again and then scooped up a small 38 caliber Smith & Wesson Detective Special. I thumbed open the cylinders and looked at the two spent cartridges and at the two that remained. I removed the two empties, readjusted the wheel forward of an empty chamber, and snapped the cylinder back with the firing pin resting on the hollow chamber. I pushed it into my pocket, picked up the water, and climbed the hill to my friend, who still sat on the trail. As I got to the path, I had a clearer picture of him and saw that drifts of snow had begun building up against his outstretched legs. The bear's arms were wrapped around his middle, and the hood on his jacket dipped low as if he were trying to sleep. The Remington 870 lay across his lap. I knelt down and looked up into his eyes. They were pinched. "Let me see." He slowly dropped his hands to the edges of his jacket, and it was only then that I noticed the dark red stains that had soaked through his woolen gloves. The jacket slowly opened to reveal a bloody mess at his abdomen, just above the navel and slightly to the right. The blood had saturated the lower part of his shirt and thermal underwear and was now leaking into his lap. I swallowed, and the word was out before I could stop it. "Shit!" He laughed, but quickly stopped as the movement in the trunk of his body caused him who knew how much pain. "Please, you are overwhelming me with your optimism." We had no idea where the bullet was, or what damage it might have done on its merry little way. With abdominal injuries, there's always the possibility of traumatic tear in one of the vascular organs, which could easily lead to massive hemorrhaging into the abdomen. Percentages for gunshot mortality rates flashed through my head. Liver, 30%, kidney, 22%, stomach, 18%, and bowels, 12%. These numbers geometrically progressed the more I concentrated on how far we were from a formal paracentesis or peritoneal lavage and computerized tomography or CT scan. I also thought about how much time I had spent standing in emergency rooms developing an unwanted education, and how badly I wished my friend and I were in one of those very rooms right now. "We have to stop the bleeding." He continued to smile.
"Yes, we do."
I turned my other glove inside out and placed it over the wound. "Is the pain high or low?" He grunted as I held the glove in place.
"In the sense of tolerance or location."
My eyes met his. "Where does it hurt?" He chuckled very lightly.
"No higher than the wound."
"Right, left?" He thought, concentrating on the pain.
"It appears to have stayed to the right."
I sighed and looked at his torn pack. I started unbuckling my belt, trying to remember if Henry still had his appendix. "You know, if one thing would go right in this case..." I pulled my belt around him and cinched the notches through. There were, of course, no holes where I needed them. "You got a pocket knife?" He began fumbling at one of his pant pockets, but I carefully took his hands away and placed them over the now saturated glove. "Hold this." I fished the knife from his pocket and pulled out a bone-handled stiletto with a 5-inch switchblade. I shook my head as I flipped it open and gauged a hole in the spot I had indented with the belt's tang. He grunted when I finally buckled it over the glove. "Too tight?"
"No."
I pulled the radio from the clip at the small of my back, amazed that it was still there after all the acrobatics. I rolled the small dial on the side, listened to the static, and keyed the handheld. "Absaroka County Sheriff's Department, this is Unit 1. Come in, base. Unit 2. I released the button and listened to the static some more. "Come in, anybody out there?" Nothing. I looked around at the mountains that surrounded us and were covered in the visual static that was also taking its toll on our reception. I thought I heard a ghosting of some voice in the cover of radio frequency. "Come in, anybody? I've got an emergency here. Anybody?" I listened, but the ghosting didn't repeat itself. "I've got two men down in the draw of Lost Twin, just past Mirror Lake." Still nothing. I turned and looked at Henry. "What happened? The abridged version." He cleared his throat.
"He was standing on the trail when I looked up, so I stopped and he fired."
"He say anything?"
"No."
"You?"
"I believe I may have gasped before clutching my stomach and falling to the ground, but that is all."
I punched the button on the radio. Come in, this is Unit 1 of the Absaroka County Sheriff's Department. Anybody out there?
I waited again.
If anybody can hear me, I've got 2 men down and need assistance on the trail of lost twin. I need backup and medical. If anybody can hear me, your assistance would be greatly appreciated.
That would be an understatement.
I sighed. Think you surprised him?
Yes, but all things considered, I think he surprised me more.
He glanced past me to George, who was starting to gather his commensurate amount of snow.
He is out?
I looked back over my shoulder.
Yep.
He raised a blood-stained hand to my arm.
You better get going.
I turned and knelt down to check George's pupils for any dilation or constriction. They appeared normal for now. I was concentrating, so it took a moment for me to process what he had said.
What?
He gestured toward the prone George Esper.
You have to get him out of here.
It hit me all at once what it was he was saying.
I'm not leaving you.
He continued to slowly shake his head.
You do not have any choice. He is smaller, and you can make it out with him.
I'm not leaving you.
He smiled.
Do not be mistaken. I have no intentions of dying. I will wait for you here.
It'll be after dark in a blizzard. We won't find you.
Then I will have to find you.
My shoulders sagged a little, but I kept my eyes on him. All right, knock it off with the mystical horseshit. You are gut-shot, and the chances of your surviving are narrow enough without you crawling around out here. His smile saddened a little.
What?
It is the mystical horseshit that is going to save my life.
I looked away and sighed.
Sorry. Do me a favor.
I raised an eyebrow.
I'm not putting you out of your misery.
I have a small bag in my front pocket. If you would please get it out for me.
I reached for the front pocket of his coat, unbuttoned the flap, and pulled out a small green velvet satchel with a leather horse and warrior stitched across the front. There were beads and feathers attached to the opening at the top, and there were a number of items under the soft fabric, some discernible, some a mystery. I handed the medicine bag to him, and we didn't mention it again.
You have to take him.
His smile brightened again.
Who knows? Perhaps the weather will cooperate.
He grimaced and shifted his weight.
Pain?
No, I have plenty, thank you.
I wanted to punch him. In spite of our hopes, the wind had increased, and with an introduction of ground fog, visibility had dropped to within 10 feet. I once again glanced back at George and considered the 170-odd pounds I was going to be carrying for roughly the next 3/4 of an hour. At least it was downhill. My attention was drawn to the foot that stuck up just above the drop-off, and I wondered if it might be a Vasque, size 9. When I turned back around, Henry had pulled the hood back a little, and his eyes had sharpened.
You must go now.
The longer I waited, the less chance he had. You want me to move you up against one of the trees for a little shelter?
No, I am not moving until you get back.
His jaw clamped shut, the muscles bunched like fists on both sides of his face, and I wished like hell that I were the one who had been shot. I slipped off my jacket, careful to take out the bottle of water, and placed another layer over his front.
What are you doing?
If I'm carrying him out, I'll be sweating like a pig once I get there. You'll need this more than me.
I opened the water bottle and drained it in one continuous chug.
Go!
I bent down to scoop up the water bottles that had fallen on the trail. He watched as I vented a lot of frustration by throwing each of them as far as they would travel. We listened as they glanced off the tree branches in the distance and landed with satisfying thumps. I turned and looked down at him and tossed the empty over the hill.
Promise you won't eat the snow.
I promise.
I gave him a quick smile of my own. I just thought I'd tell you. I'm taking you off the official suspect list.
I am comforted.
He didn't look it,
but I placed my hand lightly on his shoulder. And we understood what it was that we didn't have to say. I stood and trudged the small distance down the hill and paused at George's Boots, Vasques, size 9. I brushed the snow away and tried to gently shake the still unconscious George Esper into some semblance of awake. If he came to, it was possible that I could assist Henry and we could all get out. But there was no response. So I reached into his pockets, found his keys, and stuffed them into my Carhartts. If nobody was there to meet us, at least I would have a place to put George. But if nobody was there, how was I going to get a gut-shot 220-pound man out of the woods? I decided to tackle one problem at a time. Grasping George by one arm and drawing him over my shoulder, I leveraged him up. He didn't weigh 170, probably closer to 150, which reassured me a small amount. I stood with him over my shoulders and straightened my back, even though the majority of his weight seemed to remain on my right side. It wasn't going to be easy, but leaving him in an unconscious state and making a mad dash for the trailhead didn't seem to be an option. He might die of hypothermia, even though I wasn't so sure that Henry wouldn't. But if I was betting on who could withstand the rigors of staying alive, my money was on the bear. I was careful as I made my way up the small grade to the general flat of the trail and stopped to look down at my friend. "Couldn't you have shot him first?" He didn't raise his head, but his voice rumbled, "What do you think?" I thought about kicking his foot in response, but was afraid that any unnecessary movement should be avoided, even a sign of affection. So I turned into the wind, shrugged George a little higher onto my shoulders, and kicked off the first steps of many to come. Just a little away from all the action, I came across a nice fly rod and a creel resting beside the trail. I kicked the creel over, but it was empty. George's luck was holding. I was frustrated and getting angry, so I used that as fuel to get me going. The problem with anger is that once it burns out, you're left with empty tanks. I stopped and caught my breath. I thought about shrugging George off and taking a rest, but I didn't do it for fear that putting him back on might be more than I could manage. There was that, and then there was Henry. As I had been making my way, I had heard him begin singing. It was a low voice that found a way to cut through the noise of the wind and join with it to carry its ghostly sound across the valley. I had heard Henry sing a number of times at religious ceremonies on the reservation and at powwows that he had dragged me to. I was always surprised by the tonal quality of his voice. The power and strength were a given, but the intricate patterns that it expressed, the infinite ability instantly to change tone, always made me smile. Good friends are the ones who can remain close without losing their ability to surprise. I listened as the driving rhythm of his song carried me farther, and his voice remained with me down the long descent into West Tensleep Valley. I didn't know what kind of song it was. I didn't know what the words were, and I didn't want to know. I only listened to the complex melodies and carried them in my heart and mind as other footprints seemed to join in with mine and share the load of George Esper. Old footfalls, old as the mountains and just as enduring. I listened as other voices joined in Henry's song, strong voices, voices that carried not only over the valley, but through it. The old Cheyenne were with me, and I could feel their strength as I continued along the trail, my heavy boots forming the snow as I went.